Hello and welcome to the Koi Sports CIC Grassroots Podcast, linking business with grassroots sport to bring about positive social change. My name's David Waldridge, and in this special episode, taken from one of our recent Elite Champion networking events, I speak with legendary football manager and player Mick McCarthy. We cover a whole range of topics, from his humble beginnings on the grass pitches in Barnsley to leading Ireland's national team to a World Cup quarter-final and his eventual career in management. So without further delay, let's hear his inspiring story from starting out at a grassroots level to the heights that he's achieved today on the Koi Sports CIC Grassroots Podcast.
What are you doing, my dad? Just playing football with us in the house, driving my mother mad, driving all the neighbours mad outside, broke fences, broke gates, broke balls in windows. Really, all the time just playing on the lawn, wherever we could, we'd have a ball at our feet. My dad, being Irish, actually, was a good hurler, but he loved his football because he was banned from playing it in Ireland when he was a kid. Wasn't allowed to play it. And he'd always be doing Puskas and Hiddy Gooty, because that was the teams when they beat England a long, long time ago. And he just loved being out in the park with us, and on the rec, actually, we call it the recreation grounds in front of our house. We spent hours and hours and hours. Then, you know, as a 16-year-old, I was playing for Barnsley Boys Club, and Keith Steele, who was the son of Johnny Steele, who was the secretary at Barnsley, recommended me to go down to Barnsley. It was pretty, it wasn't glamorous, shall I say, anyway. I went down and knocked on the door of the Barnsley Football Club secretary and said, Keith Steele sent me down and apparently wanted to sign as an apprentice. And of course, the secretary knew nothing about it. It was a very, very strange start to my career.
I imagine cleaning the boots in the Barnsley changing rooms might not have been the most prettiest of sights.
I did all that, divoted the pitch, swept the terraces, cleaned the loos. That's what we used to do as apprentices, yeah.
Do you think that, though, from that early beginnings, those values that were installed in you that early on, has that stayed with you throughout your career, or has that developed more as you've learned more?
It stayed with me throughout my career. I think the fact from where I am, where I came from, those were the values. And the one guy who I can really thank for even being where I am now is Norman Rimmington, affectionately known as Rimmo at Barnsley. And the advice I took from him all the time has helped me to get where I am today, there's no doubt. But that was, I said, we used to divot the pitch on a Monday morning if they played at home, and we could hear the first team training on the training ground, and that's just where we wanted to be. So, you know, that was, if anything, real inspiration, that we wanted to be out there and not divoting the pitch.
So almost having it within touching distance, in a way, was the inspiration for you?
Sure. We wanted to be out there with them. We could hear the shouts, the whistles, the fun sometimes. Not so fun if they'd lost on a Saturday, because it was different times then. And we would be in a line. There'd be 8, maybe 10 apprentices with Rimmo and the ground staff, and we'd be walking up and down the pitch, repairing the divots. And all we wanted to be was on the training ground doing what they were doing. So it was, I don't know, it was like purgatory. You could hear it. You could almost touch it. You couldn't join in.
Well, you know what, Mick, I think you've had almost the kind of model football career. You started out at your hometown, you then moved on to the likes of Man City, you won silverware with Celtic, then got to play abroad, represent your country as well. That's pretty much the blueprint for if you wanted a footballing career, that's it.
It's a good story, isn't it? There's a book in it, I'm sure, yeah. you know, knocking on the door as a 16-year-old and being told all the time that I'd, even when I signed, and the teacher's telling me I was waiting for a job in the pit as an electrician. You know, get a career, have a trade. That's what it was. And that's what I was wanting to do. And then I signed for Barnsley. And the amount of people that told me I wouldn't make it, I was stupid, I shouldn't have done it. There's a fairly long list of them. You know what? I think they said it all hoping that I would. I wasn't the greatest footballer. I wasn't the greatest 16-year-old kid. But boy, didn't I work hard to make sure I made a living out of it. You know, every day there was no day wasted when I wanted to be the best on the training ground at what I did.
Do you think that's an important thing for any upcoming athlete then, is to know what your skills are, what you're almost best at, that you are so confident in yourself in, but also have that mental strength to realise that?
I guess, yeah, unless you're a pentathlete or a heptathlete, I guess, then that's, you know, you're very fortunate to be good at a number of things. But I believe in football, it's coaching and management, that you love the players for what they can give you and don't dislike them for what they can't give you. Because we're all different. I was one of those that headed it and kicked it and tackled and made people's life a misery playing against me. And people don't like that. You know, you disturb the opposition. We had silky wingers who could be fullbacks. We had goal scorers. We had midfield players who could create things. And I think you've got to respect every single bit of that on the pitch. Goalkeepers who, in my era, they couldn't trap a bag of cement. Let alone, you see them now, they're better footballers than some of the footballers with both feet. It's incredible how that has evolved. So we appreciated the keepers for catching it, keeping it out of his net and kicking it up the pitch. And I do think you've just got to be as good as you can in your discipline. And if you are that, you've got a chance of making a living.
Well, I'm keen to step onto your kind of playing career here. You mentioned how you were a bit of a nasty centre-back. That brought you to be captain of Ireland.
It was nasty with a smile on my face.
And that's the best. That's the best type of nasty as well. Now, you were captain of Ireland, and I'm sure this is one of your favourite international moments. Take us back to the World Cup 1990 with the penalty shootout against Romania.
We had a 90-minute battle with Romania playing against George Hagi, who was one of the best players in the world and remains. And I have his shirt in my collection, to be honest, which is a pride of place, one of those. He's a fabulous, fabulous player. And we drew. We ended up with a half an hour extra time, which was a joke, really, because neither of us wanted to lose in extra time. And it was a bit like, we have it, you have it. And, of course, I was asked if I wanted to take a penalty. I'd taken them before when I was much younger and far more confident in my ability in taking penalties. And no, I wasn't going to take one. And it was a brilliant moment for us all because we won. But the tension at it, you know, we scored all five. David O'Leary stood up and took the one that won it. But Paddy Bonner had saved the penalty prior to that.
What for you are those highlights of your international career, both as a player and as a manager as well? The Romania game, of course, that's got to be up there. But is there any other moments that really...
I always say it's the highest and lowest moment in my career as an international player was walking down the steps in Rome as the captain, leading the Irish national team out to play against Italy in Rome in the quarterfinal. And then that was the highest moment. And then walking off in tears when we'd lost 1-0 to Skilacci's winner. And I regret it to this day that I didn't feel like I could enjoy it. I was broken hearted. I thought we'd win. And I marched off up the tunnel. And to this day, I regret not celebrating with the fans because we got to the quarterfinal and we'd lost to Italy in Rome. It's not such a bad thing. And I missed the celebration with the fans. We'd had a good World Cup and we deserve to celebrate for what we've done.
I know one thing that you've mentioned before in the past is how when you originally started playing for Ireland, there was almost a kind of, well, hold on a minute, Nick McCarthy's English. Why is he playing for Ireland? And then that shifted to becoming an Irish hero. How was that settling in with the international side to begin with and then that journey to becoming that Irish hero?
There was a lot of us. There was Gerry Payton, Seamus McDonough. You know, Seamus McDonough, Mick McCarthy, you'd think they were Irish boys straight away. There was Tony Galvin, there was Chris Hughton, all these guys that were in the team initially. And I just think there was that opposition to us playing. They wanted people who were, you know, Irish-born players. And I said to everybody, my dad's Irish. I'd every right to play for Ireland as anybody else. It changed, certainly when I went to Celtic, bearing in mind that most of Ireland would be, certainly the Republic of Ireland would be supporting Celtic. And we won the double in 88. We qualified for the Euros in 88. We just had such a good season. And it all turned on its head that, you know, Jack Charlton, the English man who'd won a World Cup winner's medal with England, had come in and turned the team around and got us to the final for the first time. He just turned it completely on its head. And there was none of that antagonism towards any of us because we've been born to Irish parents, we're born in England. I've had such a wonderful time ever since. It's been brilliant.
And that wonderful time continued into management as well, first starting off at Millwall and straight away going to the Republic of Ireland's management job. Was that a hard decision or was it too big an opportunity to miss?
Too big an opportunity to miss. It wasn't a hard decision. When I consider it back now, I think it was a bonkers decision following Jack Charlton having just qualified for the Euros. Two Euros and a World Cup. No, two World Cups and a Euros. He'd been the best manager Ireland ever had. For a 36-year-old to even contemplate thinking I was going to follow him and emulate was beyond comprehension now. But it was still too good a job to turn. And Jack counseled me, and I spoke to him and asked him, and he said, mate, look, you just got to take such a wonderful job. You'll be great to take it. You'll regret it if you don't take it. And of course, if I hadn't took it, I would have ever got it again. I'd never been offered it again, I don't think. I'd had a reasonable start as a manager, 4 years with Millwall, being in the playoffs. Not so sure that, looking back, that really qualified me to be the manager of Ireland. But anyway, we finished in the playoffs twice, which was emulated what we'd done in the past. And the third time we qualified by beating, by getting to Japan and by beating Iran.
Going into Ireland as the manager at that level, do you think that was kind of the values which you learn on that grassroots pitch in Barnsley of wanting to strive to be the best, wanting to prove all the doubters wrong? Do you think that mindset was one of the reasons why, even though it was a huge opportunity, you thought you weren't ready for it, why you had to take it?
You know what? I didn't think I wasn't ready for it at the time. It's only looking back when I realised I'd had 4 years as a very, very young, you know, wet behind the ears coach and manager that I think I wasn't ready for. At the time, I was apprehensive about it, I think, as you do as any job. Certainly taking a job after Jack Charlton, the results he'd had. But I didn't go into it thinking, oh, I'm not up for this. No, I went in for it thinking, I am up for it. Whether I am going to be good enough or capable of it or not, but I was certainly up for it. If I'd have said, oh, no, I'll stay at Millwall, and, you know, things are going okay, and I'll stay here, and bottled it, well, I'd have regretted that for the rest of my life.
Was it a hard decision to take it on a second time, though, in 2018? Or was that a kind of a calling for you to go back?
Oh, no, that was very simple. That was, bearing in mind, I'd left Ipswich in March that year. And I was really looking forward to getting back into a league club. I never thought that Ireland would come calling again. And as it turned out, I mean, there's been lots of things said about what happened, because I took it on a 2-year contract. It was a bit like the first time I took it. If I hadn't agreed to take it at that, I wasn't going to get it because Stephen was going to get it in 2020. So absolute no-brainer for me. The job was there. I wanted to try and qualify for the Euros. And had we done, I'd have still been in charge of the team, I'm certain.
You've always been somewhat of a fan favourite with whatever club you've been to. And that, I think, is due to you often telling it how it is and telling it straight. Is that important for you, that kind of fan relationship with the club and being able to be honest?
Honest is a big thing with me. And that's whether it's with players or with fans. You know, if we come off and I think we've been rubbish, I say we've been rubbish. I always remember one of my chairmen coming back to you and he said, why did you say they were rubbish? I didn't say that. I said, we were rubbish. I was just being honest. The chairman was quizzing me as to my motivational skills, I guess, because I was saying the players were rubbish. I said, you listen it back. I didn't say they. I said, we were, and I never said they. It's always we. It's always a collective because I'm the one that coaches, manages and picks the team. And it is important that I have a good relationship with the fans, yeah. And pretty much most of the time I've had that. Listen, if you start losing games, it goes a little bit sour. But at most clubs, I think I'd be welcome back wherever I've been.
Mick, you come across as a man who enjoys a challenge and enjoys an achievement with that. For you, where would you say was your biggest challenge and achievement? Maybe the promotion with Sunderland in the 04-05 season, the complete rebuild of Wolves, or maybe even some more recent times with Ipswich, turning them into playoff contenders when they look doomed. Which was the highlights for you at the clubs you've been at?
I have enjoyed every single one of them. They've all been a rebuilding job, every single one, whenever I've got it. You know, even Ireland, when I took it, because Jack's team was getting old and I took it over, I had to start bringing the young ones in, Robbie Keane, Ian Hart, Gary Kelly was there, but Breeny, people like Gary Breen, Damien Duff, Matty Holland, you know, Matt Kinsler. We had to change that around. Having taken Sunderland, when I took that job, they had 19 points and with 9 games to play and they were hoping to stay in the league. Wow, I think it was a bit misguided thinking I could do that. And actually, I lost all 9 games. Lost them all. There was no point trying to draw them. You had to win them. You had to get points. You know, we talked about 40 points to stay up. We got 19. It's pretty much impossible. And I lost the next two games in the Championship as well. So I lost 11 games on the bounce. Went to Preston, won 2-0. We finished third in the league and semi-final of the Cup. That was a massive rebuilding job. That was incredible that all those players on big salaries wanted to move. And we ended up bringing in Andy Welsh from Stockport. And we were bringing lads in on no wages at all, hardly any wages from what we'd been paying, and nicking them out of Stockport's reserves and Dundee United. Neil Collins, Liam Lawrence, Jeff Whitley. People like, oh, you know, knockers for some of the players. They were brilliant. And the thing I did when I brought them, the last thing I'd do when I turn to sign them, I'd walk them down the director's box and out into the Stadium of Light. And let me tell you, that nailed it. Have you got them then? And the difference was between the players. They all wanted to play for Sunderland. They all wanted to be in that stadium. And so that was, I really loved my time there. I had it because we built something and then got to the Premier League and I was given £6 million to spend. It was never, I should have refused the money and kept the team I had, to be honest, looking back on it. We'd have probably done better because we bombed completely. And equally, Wolves was the same. They were thinking about relegation. We ended up young and hungry again, finished in the playoffs. Then second season, we finished just now. We finished seventh, I think. And then we won the league. And so those jobs were great. And Ipswich, it's always the same. It's a firefighting job. We had 7 points after 13 games at Ipswich and finished with 60. And I think 50-some went down that year. It was a ridiculous number. So every single one of them have been a challenge, but I've loved every one of them. Everywhere I've been, it's been a real challenge, but a thrill then, and totally enjoyed them.
From the outside, Mick, whenever you take on a management job, there always seems to be a good feeling around the club when you come in, because you're a guy that give the opportunity to the younger players coming through and you recognise that hunger in them to come to that next level. And all due respect to Stockport, I imagine walking them out from there to the Stadium Light is somewhat of a difference.
Absolutely, it is. And that was it. It inspired them. You know, that was, I recognised that instantly. Stadium of Light. I did it myself. I've not played in many stadiums that is, you know, I've been in World Cups and that stadium still knocked me out. Every time I walked out, brilliant, walked out of that director's room and looked at that stadium. It's amazing. And I knew it. I knew the effect it had on players. The training ground was brilliant, but nevertheless, the cool was, when you took them out there, that was brilliant. And I think you've got to create that. I'm talking about the honesty with players and treating them like people, not like footballers. They are people first and foremost. You know, they have wives, girlfriends, kids, they have problems, they have, just like everybody else. Generate that team spirit and that togetherness, you can have great times.
You're a manager, let's be honest, it's never had a job where you've had a Man City budget or one of the big boy budgets. Is that a kind of regret for you, or almost you're glad of that because you've been able to prove yourself that, well, look at what I've achieved with small, limited resources?
I have had the Man City budget, but unfortunately it was a 1983 budget when I signed there from Barnsley. I don't know, maybe you get a niche in life. I don't know if it's when we were at Wolves, we did fine the first season, second season. And the problem being is that when you try and improve your team, like the second or third season, and maybe it's happening at Sheffield United now, we were brilliant last year, and then you try and bring in what you think are better players, and you go to clubs and try and get them, and yet they're not used to the work ethic that Sheffield United players have had to work at it for the last 3 years. And you get caught between two stools a little bit, between technically better players and ones that want to run and die for the club. And I've been there. And if I had the opportunity again, I would stick with the ones that want to die for the club and not go for the technically better ones. But you get caught between the fans wanting big signings and what they look at like, you know, sexy options, and not having the ones that are getting a little bit mundane and bored with. So I understand that, because it's a business. It's, you know, it's a lot of it's glamour. But reality is, the most of it is damned hard work and making sure that you do the things properly.
Well, that was something I was going to touch on. What is it like to manage a dressing room of multiple different personalities? Because you talk about these guys who give it all for the shirt they're wearing, but that's a mindset that you have to bring to the club if it wasn't necessarily there to begin with.
Yeah, we'll have to do that in training. I believe that you, even for a training session, you want to win it. You know, even if it's a small five-a-side or eight-a-side, small-sided game, you are wanting to win that game, and nobody gives up for every single thing, for every ball you are trying. And if you're doing that in training, you'll do it on the pitch. Yeah, managing gets harder, I'll say that. When we had, you know, for instance, at Wolves, the team that had all that young and hungry and all these, you try and improve it. And I have to say, I didn't improve it, you know. I think sometimes back at Sunderland, I should have been lauded more for what I did in getting promoted. And I perhaps should have been sacked even earlier for some of the signings that I made in the Premier League because they weren't good. But they were all done thinking they were going to improve us, and they weren't. They didn't. They just didn't. And there's a big difference between the ones that get promoted to the ones that, you know, somewhere in between. Bigger clubs don't really want them in their team, and they come and try and come to your team, and not that much better than what you've got already. It really is a balancing act. I said for 2 years we stayed up pretty much with the team at Wolves that I'd signed and had got promoted and were willing to work and you know, give everything for the shirt, for the club and for each other. And then you put five or six others into that don't have that ethic. And have probably been working for teams that have been used to having the ball for 60% of the time. We probably had it 30% of the time. But you just knew that we could win games. You suddenly step up to the Premier League and we've been used to winning, what, 25 games a season? If you win 10, you're very lucky. So it's a real change in mindset.
So let's fast forward to today, Mick. You're now at Cardiff City, unbeaten at the moment as well. Congratulations.
Thank you.
Your first two games against Barnsley and Millwall, two of your old clubs as well.
No.
How is it there at the moment? And has your friend Neil Warnock give you any insight to the city of Cardiff?
No, the irony of my very first game I ever played was Barnsley, and of course my very first managerial game was at Millwall in the first two games. And Terry, my assistant TC, was at Bristol City, and we played them the third game. I was trying to find a link. For the game the other night, but I couldn't find any link to Rotherham at all. So, how is it going? At 2-0 down at Barnsley, it wasn't going very well, but the response I had from the player was brilliant. To get back to 2-2, Millwall 1-0 down again, and have to come back and equalise, and could have won that game actually. Bristol City, we played very well and dominated it. Last night against Rotherham, we had a right royal scrap. They are a handful to play against. And we stood up to it, and we had that bit of quality and managed to come away with a win. So, yes, unbeaten, but I had to work really hard for it. There's nothing given in this championship. It's a great league. I mean, we all try and get out of it at the top end. The unfortunate thing is there's some go out at the bottom end. But I'm telling you, it's a fabulous league. It's great, competitive, and good footballers in it, and really good characters and people that want to work at it. I love it. And it's a great league.
Before we pass over to questions from our elite champions, yeah. I know that sometimes you listen to radio phone-ins on the way back from matches. Have you ever thought yourself of becoming a TV pundit full-time? I know you've had a few appearances. Was it ever desirable for you?
I would like to do it more. Yeah, I thoroughly enjoy it. I've been very lucky that Sky and TalkSport and BBC in the past, all of them, I've had a chance. BT, I've done it. There's been some opportunity at different ones, but certainly with Sky and TalkSport, I've done more over the last 3 or 4 years and I thoroughly enjoyed doing it. It certainly keeps you alert when you're out of a job as well. Well, it does, because you're following the games. I'm following the Championship, which is pretty much the league I'm going to get jobs in. I've been in it a long time. I've had a good success in it. But you still see the players. You still see how it's developing, how it's evolving. So, yeah, I would certainly like to do it more.
Something you mentioned there, and I think it leads very nicely onto our first question from the Elite Champions, is the evolving nature of football and the evolving nature of the Championship. This one comes from John. Do you think that clubs that can be almost too quick now these days to change manager, change coaches, change players?
It depends whether I'm in and out of a job, that one, I guess. No, I don't sit and want people to get sacked when I'm out of a job. It's going to happen, and so you sit and you continue to do your, whether it's going on coaching courses or doing stuff and further educating yourself with the LMA, which you can, League Managers Association, or you're just watching games. Some of them are, yes, some of them just react really irresponsibly. I think sometimes you look at results and you can just sense it's going to happen. You can see it coming, and certainly with certain clubs. I mean, the one that stands out for me that has been brilliant in what they've done is Brentford. Brentford have had this way of playing, and they are very, very easy on the eye. They're a really good team. They have this money ball way of signing players. They get shut at one, there's been another one. They don't seem to have any difference. And they sell one for 30 million, sign one for 5 million. It's, you know, Ivan Toney's come, he's got 20 goals already. I was at their new stadium there the other day, brilliant. And sorry, the point I was going to make was that Thomas Frank, who was the coach there, started really badly when he got the job. He didn't go well for him at the start. Other clubs might have sacked him. They could go top of the league today if they win. And there's every chance they'll get promoted.
We'll go on to Thomas's question now. And I think we kind of touched on this already. What's your biggest challenge that you faced in sport and how did you overcome it?
I'd have to say the biggest challenge was even getting on the first rung of the football ladder. You like that, going down and knocking on that door at Barnsley as a 16-year-old and saying to the secretary at Barnsley, I'd been sent by Keith Steele, and he looked complete blank and had to go and look and ask somebody what this was all about. Could you imagine doing that now? Knocking on a door at a football club and waiting to go down the pit as an electrician. And then having to start there as a 16-year-old from not even being scouted or being with the club at all. It's just straight in and fresh. And I have to say, I went in and I just grafted at it. And then every single time you get a job, it's a challenge. You know, I've turned up here at Cardiff City and I'm 61, I was 62 this last week. And it's still a challenge. Every single time. And I'll tell you, we're facing Coventry on Saturday. That's going to be a challenge. And every single week, there's one thrown at you. But I have to say, the biggest single challenge as a player was that start. Once I got started, I can't ever say that I ever went to a club and had any difficulty in playing there. So Barnsley was my biggest one. Having got the job at Millwall, I was sort of thrown into it. The biggest challenge was Ireland as a manager at 36. Right, wet behind the ears and following. Well, I was going to say Sir Jack. He wasn't Sir Jack, but he should have been. And he should be.
Nick asking, Ole Gunnar Solskjaer had a difficult time with Cardiff, but is now thriving at Old Trafford. How much of a contrast in his fortunes are down to the vast resources that he now has at his disposal compared to when he was at Cardiff?
Oh, it's just night and day. Completely different to what he inherited at Cardiff. I can't exactly remember when he took over. I always remember an interview towards the end of the game. I think towards the end of the season, I think there were about 6 games left to play. And it was one of his assistants that was interviewed. And he said, oh, no, all we need to do is win 3 games, bang, 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 and we'll be all right. And I thought, well, they've not won 3 games on the bounce all season. And it's unlikely to happen. I don't know, it just seemed to overwhelm him. But he's gone to Old Trafford. And I think maybe because he's so revered and loved there as well, that gives him a bit more credibility there and he can do it. But it's been every, almost every week, but every fortnight, it's either been Ollie out or Ollie's the best thing since sliced bread, you know, and he has 2 or 3 good results and then he has a bad result and it just, the feeling seems to change. But I do think that's media-led as well because he's Man United. I've managed some big clubs, but I've never been at one like that. It must be a real challenge.
Would you say the media plays more of a role in the modern game now and promotes almost a fickleness to management and players?
Yeah, they've got more of an interest in Manchester United, haven't they? Manchester City, it's big news, you know. I bought a paper today and I thought, I'll have a look, see if we got our report. And it says, there's the Sheffield Wednesday report. And then underneath it says, oh, and by the way, Cardiff beat Rotherham away 2-1. Oh, that's great.
All playing that on Rotherham.
No, it's just the way it is. If it's Man United, it don't matter what happens. It's a big story. And I think for him to be managing that now as well as he is doing, because it did look, I watched them against Brighton. I was doing the game for Talksport, actually. I watched them. And they were abysmal for 45 minutes. They were awful. They didn't look to me like they ran around. And of course, it was in that spell where every time they went behind, they came from behind and won.
We'll go to Dev now with his question, saying, you've always shown a willingness to give opportunities to players who might have not come through a youth system or the system of football, so to speak, much like with Mo at your last job in Ipswich. What is your thinking to using this kind of approach? And do you think more coaches and managers should be more kind of open to being like that, maybe finding those players in non-league, maybe not finding them through the youth academy system and so on?
Look, I'm not going to big myself up as somebody just scouring that because I have to. If somebody gave me a whole chunk of money to go out and buy the best players and we could be the best team, then I'm not going to say I wouldn't do it. But I've generally inherited clubs where it's been, well, relegation, Sunderland to the Championship, and straight away there you're having to cut your cloth accordingly. Wolves, they'd been relegated, again, cut the cloth accordingly. And I love that challenge. I mean, the thought of Michael Keightley, that Gray's was a free and we brought him in. I remember our lads that day went, wow, who's he? And we signed him and he was brilliant. He was one of those that helped get us promoted at Wolves. Him and Matt Jarvis, who we signed from Gillingham for about 600 grand. So there was a big difference, but they were brilliant, the two of them. And I got so much pleasure out of getting somebody from that level of football and then helping him, coaching him and managing him along with TC and Taff at the time, the assistant Ian Evans. To get them to the level where they end up playing in the Premier League is just wonderful. I love that because I enjoy that thrill more than certainly signing a player that's supposed to be good, finding out that he's not that good and maybe don't want to play for the club. So I do like those young and hungry ones, I have to be honest.
Now, Chris is asking, what is your best experience in football?
It's bizarre, isn't it, that I would choose a defeat of 1-0 as to be my best experience. But walking down the Olympic Stadium in Rome with a captain's armband for Ireland, you don't get much better than that. It can only get better than that twice. That's the semi-final and the final. So that was my proudest moment ever as a player. And you know, I got promoted with Barnsley from the fourth to the third, third to the second. I was promoted with City from the second to the first. I've not had any Champions League medals or all like that. You know, I've won two cups. They won the double with Celtic, and then we beat Rangers in the cup final the last time. And all those are brilliant, and they're much happier occasions. But that game, that whole experience of the World Cup 1990 is my best experience, and I never got any higher than that. So to walk down and lead the national team out of the armband on was pretty special.
Kai's asking that Fergie has been quoted before that he bases his career on the players and the staff happiness rather than the fans. What is your take on that kind of managerial mindset?
I agree with him. Yeah. The players are happy and playing well and all the staff are. The fans are happy. You keep fans happy by having a good team and by how they play, how they work. You know, they respond to the players. It's not the other way around. Tell a lie. I'm not going to say, because players do respond to the fans. They do. But it's not in terms of being happy and content. They respond to their chivying and their bellowing and their support, and they make them play better. But, you know, Manchester United are a good team, you know, Beckham and Giggs and all those guys, but the fans love them, but they get behind them because they love them and they make them better. You've got to look after the players. You have got to have a good camaraderie, a good team spirit with the players and staff, and I think a harmony. You're not the best pals. I know Alex is a really good pal of mine. And he would be hard on them, but he'd be fair on them. But he loved them all. And he could do both.
James, huge Barnsley fan, asking, would you ever be tempted to come back and manage Barnsley?
Well, there's a couple of times, James, where it nearly happened, right early on in my career. And I've never been mooted for it ever since, wherever I've been in a job, out of a job. I have to say, the guy who's there now, forgive me for, we just played them recently, drew 2-2. He's doing a brilliant job. We had one of the hardest games I've ever had in the Championship 2 weeks ago against them. And they were 2-0 up. We ended up being 2-2. He has got them working the socks off. I'd leave it in his hands if I was you. Doing all right, him.
As Lars asking, how do you develop drive and determination in players where, for example, you might have more of a technical, gifted player who maybe doesn't have that mental side of their game to the same standard?
You have to show him what you want out of the game. Wherever I've been, we've had that. I think we talked about it earlier, you'll have some that can head it and kick it, you'll have some who can dribble, you'll have some who score goals, some will put crosses in, some will keep them out of the goals. There's all different jobs on the pitch. But you'd like them all to be blooming determined to work as hard as they can. And I'd always say, put a shift in. You've got to do it on the training ground because there's no other place for it. And it doesn't matter what game it is, you put sessions on that stress them up, that make sure that they are being challenged. People are going to run past them. Are they going to let them run past them? Do you go man for man? They won't like it, some of them, but it shows them what they have got to do to win games. And I ask all the players I ever ask, I say, well, who's the hardest working team in the league? Yeah, if you don't want to run around, you might as well not be here. Liverpool last year were by far and away. Man United with Alex Ferguson's teams used to run over the top of people. Man City, hardest working teams. So anybody that says to me they don't want to work hard and not compete, they're not staying with me, I'm afraid.
We'll finish with our final question from John. With the absence of fans in the stadium at the moment, and I imagine this is quite a new experience for yourself, what effect does that have on you, the players, and the game itself?
It's funny that, because TC, Teddy Connor, my assistant, said to me today, can you imagine that? We've just won two on the bounce. Can you imagine the response would be now, having beaten Bristol, our local derby, what it would be like now on Saturday with the fans in? I said, I can't. It would be amazing. We've just won a couple. We've stepped up looking forward rather than behind. But I said, imagine what it would have been like at Rotherham last night when they equalised with 15 minutes to go and it was snowing. The ferocity of their fans might have driven them on to win that game, but they're not there. It is very strange. I've watched games, I've commentated on games when the fans aren't there, and it's just not the same. And fans do get a response from players. They do get players to run harder, run faster, tackle harder, compete. And so we're not working at the optimum, definitely. We can't be without fans.
And that's it for this special episode of the Coy Sports CIC Grassroots Podcast. Thank you to Mick McCarthy for taking the time to share his amazing stories, along with Sports Trader, our partnered charity. If you'd like to find out more about the amazing work Coy Sports is doing within the grassroots sector on a regional and international level, head over to coysports.co.uk. Thanks for listening, and don't forget to download and subscribe so that you never miss any of our future episodes. And we'll hear more from the grassroots sport and business community next time.